Welcome to Stupid Not Stupid. I'm Matt, here with my man Jason, the co-host who eats red pills for breakfast on the daily.
I don't even taste them anymore.
Free your mind, Jason. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. At this point, I think my mind is so free that it fell right out. Yeah.
Speaking of things that are going to make you lose your mind, we haven't done one of these in quite a while, Jason, but you know what it's time for?
Uh-oh.
It's time for...
Their Stupid Edition.
I don't know. Who was the last guest we had on the show? I can't even remember. Is it Dr. Aaron? Dr. Aaron on the Hobbit Should Have Walked to Mordor? Was that the episode?
I think that might have been. Wow. That feels like it was a long time ago. Yeah.
It was a long time ago. Well, like Dr. Aaron, our guest on the show this week is another returning, I wouldn't call him a fan favorite because I don't think anyone liked him. And we certainly didn't even, beyond editing and posting, I don't think we listened to his episode because it lowered the aggregate intelligence of us and everyone who subscribes. But it's Dr. TJ, the guest who fate has returned to us. Dr. TJ is of fame of our free will episode. So welcome back to the show, Dr. TJ.
Hello, hello. Thank you. It's glad to be back. Although, you know, none of us had a choice in this matter, but I'm happy to be here.
So first, what I'm going to do is do the housekeeping. We'll get the drinks out of the way. And then I want to ask you about that, Dr. TJ. So we'll do guests first. Dr. TJ, what are you lubricating your argument instruments with this week?
So I have something extremely special and close to my heart. This week, I have what's called a natty motherfucking daddy. Yeah. Like, you guys like that?
The thing that's funny is...
I think, like, I just threw up in my mouth a little.
I know there are other options available to you because, as Jason has mentioned on the show multiple times, there is a 7-Eleven between my house and his house, and that's where most of the alcohol we drink on the podcast comes from. And he does manage to get craft beer from the 7-Eleven. So I know you fully sustain yourself off convenience store food and beverage, Dr. TJ, but... You don't have to just buy Natty Ice.
I know no other options. And just for you guys, I have this, a little bit of ASMR. Ooh, that's nice. Ooh.
I love how you waited to open it.
I can almost taste the aluminum.
extra sadness in this one. Okay, well, since Dr. TJ has it on one end of the spectrum, I'm going to go back to one, also not necessarily a fan favorite, but from last time around, Ballantini's Finest Scotch, which is another remnant of the Renninger liquor cabinets of yore here in my childhood home.
Yeah, you know it's a fine, fine scotch when it's made in Italy. Yeah.
Jason, what do you got this week?
Well, I am still working on that lovely bottle of the Catoctin Creek Ragnarok Rye, enjoying that immensely.
I tagged them on Twitter on our last episode, and I was like, hey, we gave you guys a shout-out, and they just ignored us.
Well, when I
tagged
finished
Ragnarok,
this...
I tagged Catoctin Creek, I tagged everything.
Rat bastards. Yeah, and then normally I would be accompanying that with a raging bitch, but for TJ's benefit, I stopped at the 7-Eleven and instead picked up some Flying Dog, The Truth.
Nice. The Truth. I'd like to see it.
All right. TJ, what we wanted to do is give you an opportunity before we jump into the two principal things we're going to do with this week's Stupid Not Stupid question. And give you, maybe we should set a timer here. I don't want to give you too much airtime. That might be dangerous for the internet. But could you give us a recap of your position on free will, which was the topic of your previous appearance on the show?
Sure. It's very simple. Free will doesn't exist because with our mind that we're born with and the experiences that we have, they kind of continuously culminate off of each other. And we end up being in the same exact position no matter what. And so because you didn't have the ability to choose your mind, and because you never had the ability to choose where you were born into, every single variable kind of falls into place after that, and we end up in this cycle.
So I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, and I don't want Dr. TJ to ever think I'd be apologizing to him. But I think that what Dr. TJ laid out in his last appearance and what he said just now might actually provide some foundational evidence for the topic that we're going to cover this week. So I just want to get on the record that I might be recanting an earlier position, although probably not.
I was going to say, that's fine. Please know that I am still firmly on the that is a bunch of horseshit side of the fence.
Okay, well, before we unveil the question. Before we unveil the question for this week, there was it was kind of funny. Last week we talked about the movie Don't Look Up, but I hadn't even seen it yet, and so that really wasn't that wasn't the motivation for doing the could we stop a near Earth object from hitting the Earth topic. It was just pure coincidence,
right? You know, yeah. Something that is not preordained.
in the instance of this week's topic, there actually was a rationale behind it, and it was the release of the new Matrix movie. So before we go any further, I think we need to take a quick aside here and do a quick review of the Matrix movie and what we thought of it. So
by the way, just for the sake of being on the right side of history, we are definitely going to be talking about the film. So if anybody hasn't seen it,
oh, yeah.
Spoilers.
Yeah, spoilers. Okay, my bad. Spoiler alert. Although it wouldn't be up to you when you watched it anyway.
That's
so
right. Yeah.
Now you're getting it. Now you're getting it, Matt.
All right. Usually we let guests go first, but I don't feel like that right now. So Jason, what were your thoughts on the film, The Matrix? Oh, this one is Matrix Resurrection. Reloaded was the last one. This is Matrix Resurrection, right?
So Reloaded was actually the second. So you had The Matrix, you had The Matrix Reloaded, you had The Matrix Revolutions, and now you have Resurrection.
Okay. What did you think about The Matrix Resurrection?
So I was a fan of all three of the original films, and I know that that's a rarity. I think most people only like the first one. The second two tend to get a bad rap, and I get it. I enjoyed them, but I have spent a whole lot of time reading all the philosophy that was sort of behind the premises of those movies. This one came out, and I've actually seen it twice. I watched it the night that it came out, and then I watched it again last night in preparation for this episode. The first time that I watched it, I actually didn't much care for it. I found it to be too far removed from the style and the substance of the first three films, and I found it very disconcerting. Having gone back and watched it last night, though, I caught a bunch of stuff that I had not caught in the first viewing that actually both tied it back to the earlier themes of the original movies. And also, I think, made it a really worthy addition to the storyline. I thought it was very, very clever, really interesting. I liked it a lot.
Dr. TJ, what are your thoughts on The Matrix Resurrections?
I thought it was pretty good. I enjoyed the fuck out of it. I think, like, thinking back to when I had
originally...
I feel
like those are two different data points on a scale, Jason. Like, it's pretty good and enjoyed the fuck out of it are, like, far apart on the XY axis. But anyway, yeah, either or, whatever works for you. Continue, Dr. TJ.
No, that makes sense. What I mean when I say enjoyed the fuck out of it, I really liked all of the action. And I think, you know, sometimes I feel like we're missing that in some movies. They feel a little bit copy cutter of just, like, regular, like, superhero... This is the guy, he's going to do this, and it's just going to end in like the very stereotypical way. I think with The Matrix, it was pretty interesting because you had those bits of actions that felt a little bit more real. And I mean, God, dude, Keanu Reeves is one, he's hot as fuck. Two, he's just bae. I mean, he's so good at everything he does, and he's the most likable person on the fucking planet. And three, there were some really, really solid lines. I think the worst thing about the new Matrix is kind of what I ascribe to almost all new movies. They feel a little bit zoomer-ish, which is the opposite of what I call you both, boomers. And if you had to – so zoomer just basically means that you're kind of like a Fortnite kid and, you know, you ask your parents for Fortnite money to spend in Fortnite. And that's kind of what I feel like a lot of movies are a little bit pandering to now. And the way that they had some kind of cheesy jokes in it, I'll accept it. But, you know, I still think it was a good movie. But I think the way that we're moving in that direction, it's sometimes kind of annoying. And this isn't just a critique of Matrix. This is more of all of these movies are doing it. So I don't really blame Matrix for doing it. I think Thor Ragnarok kind of started this trend. And movies just kind of found success after this. So overall, Keanu is fucking amazing. There were some amazing moments in it, and I enjoyed it. Although they should have had Morpheus in it. That is a real fucking setback. I think they wrote in the new guy well, but I miss the main Morpheus dude.
So I actually, before I watched it, Dr. TJ, I watched a Everything You Should Know Before You Watch the Matrix Resurrections video, and I didn't know this. There's some like weird like 2000-something computer game that is the official sequel to The Matrix 3, and in that video game, Morpheus dies, and it's technically canon. So they couldn't bring him in. So I think that's the reason why.
Yeah, all of that is true. They also did a number of comic books that were canon to that series as well. The point that I was going to make, I genuinely don't care if you call me a boomer because you clearly don't know what you're talking about most of the time anyways. But I find it interesting that your issue with Morpheus not being in the movie is a complete misunderstanding that in this film, he would have been about 95 years old. And you just seem to have this temporal difficulty. Like, I'm 30 years too young to be a boomer, and Matt's 15 years younger than I am.
It's not an age thing. It's just the way it is.
Well, since no one asked, I'll give my evaluation of the movie real quick. I felt like, I don't know, on the scale of pretty good to enjoyed the fuck out of it, I'm going to be on barely good. I felt like watching this movie was like getting unplugged from the Matrix a third of the way through it. I think the first act of the movie, the first, I guess, because it's a pretty long one, so I guess the first 45 minutes was so freaking good. It was excellent. The beginning of the movie was so good. The direction that they took, the way they approached it, the perspective they were putting into it, and all the things they were making you think about, with the video game angle and trying to understand like how this fit into the reality of Neo's situation being quote unquote dead after being left with machines at the end of the third movie. And then there's this line that he has when he's having a meeting with the video game exec at the company that he works at, where he says, the Matrix is the name of the game, I think.
Correct.
That he's making, right? It's called that. Yeah. So he's like, the Matrix made you think. It fucked with your head. It wasn't just another action game. Like it gave you perspective and made you look at the world differently and question things. And I was like, that's awesome. Yeah. And that's what this movie's going to do. This is going to be great. And then I felt like I got unplugged from the Matrix because after the first act of the movie, it literally became recycled Marvel Cinematic Universe bullshit. It was just like pointless fight scenes, undeveloped characters with a predictable ending. I thought the first third of the movie was brilliant. I thought the second two thirds were either okay or sucked. And that balances out to be an okay movie.
So I understand your point. I agree with you that I think the strongest point of the film was the first act. I thought that the second act was actually the most philosophically poignant, though, because I think it had the most social commentary. Now, it was, like I said, I didn't catch that the first time I watched the film. But going back and watching it, particularly the stuff with Neil Patrick Harris's character, the architect, I thought it was really poignant discussing this idea that the first three movies are basically about the value of free will and the value of questioning what you see around you. And at the end of the, for, you know, if you guys hadn't followed the original trilogy, basically what happens is there's a war between the machines and the people. And the truce is that anyone who wants out of the Matrix will be let out, and anyone who wants to stay in the Matrix will stay in. And this movie is basically a Matrix full of all the people who stayed. And it's this interesting discussion as to why they stayed. And there's, you know, sort of a subplot having to do with the machines sort of reneging on the cut and dry deal that they had made at the end of the third movie. But it's also all about this idea that this isn't discussing intellect or free will. This is discussing emotion. And I thought that was fascinating and a really interesting commentary, social commentary on what we're experiencing today.
No,
that movie then. Make that whole movie. Don't try to squeeze in every character from all three subsequent films with like a predictable chase scene at the end and then the predictable ending. Have the movie be about like Neo trying to convince Trinity to take the pill. Like, it doesn't even need to be an action movie. This could have just been like a psychological thought piece. Sorry. Go ahead, Dr. TJ.
No, yeah. I think Jason's definitely onto something. I think one of the best parts where you felt connected with the movie was when Keanu basically questions not just his existence, but even if he is understanding reality correctly, whether or not it was actually worth it. And, you know, I think having that internal struggle is kind of what makes not only Keanu so hot, but just movies like this in general so good, is you see that character development in the main character, and you know, the things that he's thinking about and moving towards. So that aspect I really liked. Also, when it comes to Keanu, the best line was when, oh my God, when he, I think it was when the new Morpheus offered him the red and the blue, and he just looks at him and he goes, fuck. And he said it in such a fucking perfect way. It was the best fuck I've ever heard in my life. And that, I mean, he is just so good at these lines. And I think you see it a lot in John Wick. But man, I love that kind of, I don't know, charisma that he has throughout the movie. But that was, that might be one of the best lines in all of movie history, easily.
So my favorite line in the movie, because it was so dumb, it was such a bad joke, and it was amazing that they did it. I didn't catch it at all the first time I saw the movie. So one of the new characters that they introduce in this film is this woman who's the captain of the ship that Keanu Reeves' character ends up on. But her name is Bugs, right? And it didn't occur. She has this accent when she talks fast that was sort of difficult for me to follow. So the first time through, I didn't catch it. But she's introducing herself in one of the earliest scenes, and she's saying, you know, hey, my name is Bugs, kind of like the bunny from the old cartoons. And then she's got the white rabbit tattoo on her shoulder and on and on. So you kind of get all of this. But there's this one throwaway scene about two-thirds of the way through the movie where they're on the ship and one of their people is in medical difficulty and the doctor of the ship is there working on him. And he's like, oh, man, this doesn't look good. And she looks at him and goes, what's up, doc?
Okay, that is brilliant. I didn't catch that.
That is funny.
All right, well, I could actually, we could do a whole episode on this because I have a lot of other thoughts on problems with this movie, but I'm gonna swallow the blue pill and move on from this.
But you admit Keanu showed the fuck up for this movie, right?
I like Keanu Reeves, sure.
Yeah, that's and you still have to watch John Wick.
Yeah, I still have to watch John Wick. That is true. But I did watch Wolf of Wall Street on your recommendation.
Oh, thank God. So welcome to the world.
Not that anyone else listening to this cares, but Dr. TG was very upset. I had not seen Wolf of Wall Street, which is basically like a fanboy flick for a guy who committed a bunch of crimes who's still making money off his crimes. But whatever, we can talk about that later.
Shortly after that film came out, he actually had a heart attack and died. So he's not currently making money off of the film, but his estate probably is.
His estate is. Okay, well, I need to get on that estate earlier, I guess. stupid or not stupid, Matrix Resurrections, Jason?
I would go not stupid. I there's enough in the film that I found enjoyable that I didn't mind watching it a second time.
Dr. TJ?
I lean on not stupid. I think obviously we talked about some of the problems, but I think if you sit down and you relax and you have a natty daddy, it's a good movie, baby.
All right, I'm going to say not stupid also just because I thought the first third of the movie was so good, it redeems the rest of the mindless bullshit. Well, now that we're plugged back in, we can move on from the Matrix Resurrections and we can get to our stupid, not stupid question for this weekend. This is the reason it was related to the Matrix movie release, because our stupid, not stupid question for this week is, stupid or not stupid, we are living in a computer simulation. Are you laughing because it's funny, Jason? Are you laughing because you were coded to think it was funny?
Yeah, right. Exactly. It was destiny that I would laugh. No.
No. It's not destiny. It's, I guess, in a way, it's preordained because it was coded to happen. It was a 0 and 1. I think Dr. TJ's destiny is more of a philosophical destiny. I'm talking about an actual predetermined as opposed to preordained, I guess.
Yeah, I find that even less understandable, less valid than the idea that a normal life within a functional reality is somehow preordained. Yeah, the idea that it's actually a simulation is even more ridiculous to me.
Okay. All right. Do you have an initial reaction, Dr. TJ, before we dig into it?
So, oh man, you guys are going to hate me. I actually don't think that this is that implausible. And honestly, I really think it comes down to one question. So the biggest question as it pertains to the simulation is whether or not humans can create the technology to make it indistinguishable from real life. And I think that if humans get to a point where you can literally plug into something just like a VR headset or like a video game, and you actually can't tell the difference between real life and a virtual simulation, I don't see how it couldn't be, I guess, plausible that we would just eventually live in simulation after simulation after simulation, because we wouldn't be able to tell the difference. And if we can just create that one time, then an endless chain of simulations comes, and then from there we're just doomed. We will never know whether or not we're actually living in the simulation because we had the capability of creating it that first time.
So Dr. TJ actually isn't very far off from the foundation of the mainstream articulation of this theory. So this really this idea really gained
traction. I like to hear that.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you're really using the term mainstream very, very loosely here.
Well, the mainstream theory of the simulation hypothesis gained traction following the publication of a paper by one of Dr. TJ's fellow PhDs, Dr. Nick Bostom of Oxford University. You know Dr. Nick?
He also likes natty daddies, if I recall correctly.
So in 2003, Dr. Bostrom imagined in his paper a technologically adept civilization that possessed immense computing power, far beyond what we have available to us now at our current level of technological development. But that level of computing power enabled that civilization to simulate new realities with conscious beings in them. So given that scenario, given that hypothesis, that level of technological development has been achieved at some point in the existence of the universe, his argument lays out a set of parameters, each building off the other. And if none of the parameters are stupid, then it's not stupid that we are likely living in a simulation. And I just want to be clear, if none of my parameters are stupid, then it's not stupid is his academic assessment that he put forward. That was his academic hypothesis. I'm not putting words in his mouth. So I think what we should do is go through one by one Dr. Bostom's parameters that either prove or disprove. They're either stupid or not stupid questions. Go down the list. And if we can clear one, we move to the other. And if we get to the end, we're probably living in a simulation.
That's fine. A couple of points of clarification before we go forward with this, though. First of all, this was not the first time somebody came up with this idea, right? This concept dates back. I mean, Descartes talked about this. You could argue that the shadows in the caves with Plato, like,
you're going to hate this, Jason. Do you know why it got traction? Do you know the story?
I think that I knew at one time, and I don't remember the story behind this.
Bostom puts it forward. Someone mentions it to Neil deGrasse Tyson on Star Talk.
Of course.
And that's the point
what it was.
To him.
Yep.
And then someone subsequently asked the question of Elon Musk at one of the fanboy forums he does. And Elon Musk used the number. He said there was almost like a 600 billion in one chance that we are the baseline civilization, that we're almost certainly a simulation, which isn't exactly what Bostom is trying to articulate.
Absurd number based on it's using. Yeah, it's making a bunch of assumptions that we covered in the Drake equation, to a ridiculous degree.
As you made the point about the deep philosophical
right.
catalysts for this, I just wanted to throw an Elon Musk for you.
Yeah, you had to go ahead and skewer the make me ashamed of this entire episode. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Thanks.
but Jason's absolutely right.
Yeah. So yes, and then the other point that I wanted to clarify, when you're talking about a simulation, are you talking about us as humans existing within a simulation, or are you talking about us being part of the simulation, like that we are basically AIs in a simulation?
So either of those could be true. So I think that question will answer itself as we go through the five questions.
Okay.
So either of those could be plausible. Dr. TJ, do you have an initial thought before I lay out the first parameter that we have to make a call on, stupid or not stupid?
I definitely think it's going to be not stupid, but also to Jason's point, I do think in the kind of realm of talk around simulation, I think it is the latter. I think most people, when they imagine the simulation, they think of us living in the simulation, not necessarily being coded as AI.
All right. Well, let's do science, boys.
Yeah. So it's the brain in the jar theory as opposed to we're all fake people. Right.
Yeah.
Either's possible. All right. question number one, or parameter, I'm sorry, parameter number one. We could simulate consciousness and or the human brain. And before we go far, Jason, you better not disagree with this one, because I don't have to edit in clips of you on our – man, which episode? Oh, it's Immortality, on our Immortality episode, where you basically agree that, yes, as given the trajectory of technology, it's not – insane that we could at some point download and or simulate a human brain.
I said that it was within the realm of physical possibility. We're nowhere remotely close to being able to do it.
Okay. All right. Dr. TJ, where are you on this?
I think that is 100% a capability, and it's scary to think about, to be honest. But I mean, kind of nice in the same realm. I mean, if you're living now and you could just download yourself, you're immortal, as I heard you discuss in a previous episode.
Yeah. So it's just the simulation of chemical reactions, right? The human brain is billions of neuronical interactions that are basically fundamentally just chemical interactions. But the complexity is at such a massive degree that being able to solve all of those variables in real time at the speed that would be necessary to duplicate a consciousness, the computing powers is far more, it's 10 times what we're capable of doing as an entire species right now. So yeah, it's plausible. It's just we're not anywhere even remotely close.
Jason is absolutely right. So actually, I was looking at the same kind of hurdle for this checkpoint. So I looked it up, and you would have to have a computer capable of handling a million trillion operations per second. So that's if you took the population of the Earth, you assign them an average 50-year lifespan, and then stretched out the number of computations that the average human brain is doing every second, and then had to sustain that. So it is a million trillion operations per second. That's more operations than there are stars in the observable universe.
Right. Jesus. Right. We're talking about huge numbers.
Yeah. And it's adapting, huge, right? I mean, if you have a thought, a new thought, well, not necessarily new, but if you have a thought, you know, it's going to have to keep kind of evolving to the point where you can kind of react and track that. Yeah, that sounds insane.
Yeah.
Tough, so but doable.
Potentially doable, but I think this question will also answer itself when we get to the second parameter. But this is where I want to throw out the first theory and kind of the first matrix connection here. But the video game theory, I think, actually has a meaningful role to play here. So when you're playing a video game that, and this is where Dr. TJ probably has more insight than I do, but carries a high strain on the computing power of the device that you're playing on, what the video game does is it only renders what you can immediately see and isn't rendering the rest of the game around you, only what's immediately visible to the player, which drastically reduces the load on the computing power of the system that you're running the game on. So you see as you scroll. So if we were living in a simulation and the super advanced beings that were running the simulation were looking for an efficient way to make it work, you could drastically reduce that million trillion operations per second that needed to be simulated by just only simulating what's immediately in front of your simulation subjects.
So are we assuming that, for instance, I'm in a simulation, but both of you are part of the simulation, as is the rest of the world?
That was my next point. What if only one of us is the actual protagonist of the simulation?
So it's me.
And everyone else is an agent of the simulation.
Right. And to your point about just the scrolling, wasn't there a Rick and Morty episode where they got caught by aliens and that's exactly what was happening and that's the way they defeated it was by getting ahead of the scrolling? Anyways, yeah.
In video games, that is kind of one of the best, I guess, ways to help people with a lower processing power computer. And it's actually amazing. I mean, if you look at some of the ways that professional gamers do as well, you can see that they put their settings very low so that way they can have this super, super high rendering rate far away because, you know, you kind of need to have that at a more professional level. But, you know, saving that computer power and being able to run through what would be millions of blades of grass in The Witcher and being able to actually do it on a computer, you know, it's pretty incredible. And it's a great way that they've kind of itemized what's important when you're playing the video game.
Yeah. I think No Man's Sky, I don't know if you might not be familiar with this one, Jason. Dr. TJ, I don't know if you've played it, but No Man's Sky is a great example of this. So there are 18 quintillion planets in the video game No Man's Sky. And I don't think any two players have ever met in the game. It's like an open world sandbox game where people are just flying around. I don't know if people have ever even actually met in it, but all of those things are randomly generated and you only see them as you go.
Yeah. And there was actually a lot of drama about that because No Man's Sky, the developers had put out that it was a multiplayer game. And so when so many people bought it, they thought it would be like a standard Call of Duty or any other type of co-op-esque game where you can hop in with your buddies Jason and Matt, and then all of a sudden they're on a planet 20,000 million fucking light years away that you have no access to, and you can only randomly run into them. But I mean, it's just so improbable. Yeah, that's kind of what happened. So people got pretty upset.
Which, by the way, is actually a very accurate representation of the distances in the universe and why I think it's likely that there are other civilizations in the universe, but we're very unlikely to run into them, is because of the time and distances involved. Also, Matt, to your point, no, I'm not familiar with this game because, as you should know very well, I'm not familiar with any video game after like Robotron 2084.
And Archon, which you're still on a losing streak for.
We'll get you up to speed.
Should we make a call on parameter number one? Can we all agree, theoretically, not stupid?
And theoretically, we're gonna get, yes.
So, yeah, some of the ambiguity will be answered in the next parameter. Can we all agree, right, not stupid on parameter one?
Since we were sort of attaching this argument to the Matrix stuff, one of the conceits of the Matrix movies is that they were simulating a time far in the past, even, you know, like several hundred years before the events that were happening in the time that they were simulating it. So the idea that we would be living in a simulation where that computing power is absolutely impossible might make sense in trying to hide the fact that someone is immersing us in a simulation.
All right, so we're at not stupid?
Sure.
Say it, Jason. Say it.
Sure. No. We're fine with that one.
Okay. So parameter number two, technological progress will not stop. So that's question two. And when we look at the trajectory of technology now, it's only speeding up. I don't know what did we say on our AI episode with Dr. Newton? Basically, computing power is doubling every 2 years or 1.5 years at this point. So are we on a trajectory from a technology perspective that we're not going to hit? Are we likely to hit a wall in terms of technology, specifically computing power?
I would argue, yes, we are, because we've already done this before. I mean, you were talking about computing power increasing at the moment, but that wasn't always true. For a long time, computing power was a real difficulty, and it was memory that was increasing at a very predictable rate, which is Moore's Law, which we discussed on that episode as well. But we have run up against the end of Moore's Law from a memory standpoint, and now we're looking at computing power standpoint, which is a completely different metric. So I find it totally plausible that quantum computing turns out to be a dead end, and we run up against the material science limits of computing power, and at a certain point, you know, you run out of electricity, you run out of silicon, there are actual physical limits that we could hit. We might not, but we could. So I don't think that it's inevitable that technology just continues to increase unabated.
Dr. TJ has a real big smile on his face.
I think it is inevitable, but I sure as shit don't have a scientific answer. I just think it is. So sorry. But yeah, that's my answer.
So yeah, I mean, you can't say one way or the other if we're going to hit the wall, but there are realistic pathways to breaking through the walls that we see on the horizon, right? So Jason mentioned quantum computing. We're not there yet with quantum computing, and maybe we could do a whole other episode and bring Dr. Newton back on how quantum computing works. But basically, it doesn't. But it would be like helium-3 and fusion, a game changer in our computing capacity. And I think that when I was reading, doing my own research,
before this episode,
what I saw was a quantum computing complex, roughly the size of a city, is theorized to be needed to be able to run the kind of simulations that we're talking about. The other thing I saw was, and Jason, you might be familiar with this, the Matryoshka brain. Are you familiar with this?
Matryoshka brain. So it's
Matryoshka brain. Man, I am on a roll on mispronouncing things.
Well, Russian is tough. A Matryoshka doll is the Russian doll that, you know, there's a smaller one and then a smaller one, then a smaller one. So yeah, that's the concept that they're talking about.
So the Matryoshka brain, yeah, is a doll that is basically done by an advanced civilization built around a sun that harnesses its entire power for computing, for running computations. So you could either you know, enclose a sun in a giant mega structure that runs a server farm in space, which is a great way to cool it, I bet. Or develop a quantum computer the size of a city. That's really the pathway to what we imagine to the walls in technology and computing and memory, like you talked about, Jason, that we see coming up.
Right. And that concept is actually just an advancement of a science fiction concept called a Dyson sphere, where you're...
It's actually Dyson's son, I think, that comes up with this.
Oh, okay. Well, he was the guy, I think in the last episode I mentioned.
Yeah, we mentioned him then too.
Yeah. Had written the book about the Orion Project. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have to admit to ourselves, technology is speeding up. Computing power continues to double at an incredible rate. It is possible that we hit a wall. Like, we can identify the walls we're going to hit. It is possible we're going to hit them. We have come up to kind of decision points before. Can we continue? Can we not continue in technology? And we've always been able to overcome them and continue to advance.
Have we?
So for me, I've got...
that's a very linear view of technology, man. I think there have been a lot of dead ends.
There have been technological dead ends, but from a computing perspective, there hasn't been a period where computing power has stopped. Like, when has there been a stagnation in the growth of computing power? When was the last time?
Well, again, we're talking about computing power as opposed to other aspects of computing, because we have definitely run into a memory issue.
Okay, but the efficiency and power of computers, whether it be from a memory or from a RAM perspective, has, whether you're increasing one or increasing the other, we have continued to increase the power and efficiency of computers constantly without stopping.
Right, but again, it goes back to the methodology. If you're talking about just running things in parallel, yeah, you can keep doing that until you run out of space or you run out of units. But that's not the same thing as increasing the capability of it's not fundamentally changing the way that you're doing computing. So it's not
right, but
increasing.
You double the amount of machines you have doing it and you double the power of what you're doing.
Right.
That's what
but again, what I'm saying is that is not an increase in computing power in the way that you're talking about, because there is a hard stop to that.
Eventually, yes. Eventually,
right.
Yes.
And if you don't overcome that, then you hit that hard stop. So it's not this okay. inevitable march towards progress is what I'm trying to say.
Let me ask the question this way then.
Sure.
The parameter was technically technological progress will not stop. Let me pose it this way. Technological progress is not likely to stop before we hit the point where a simulation would be possible. We'll at least get to that point before we hit the energy quotient. There's just no more space and energy left in the world to compute anything further. We would hit the ability to create a simulation like we're talking about before we hit that wall.
A million trillion calculations a second is a whole lot.
That's only if you're doing everybody, though.
Okay. Well, once again, I like how you move the goalposts on this. Yeah.
No, we set that goalpost in the last parameter because, Jason, you could be the only sentient one here, so maybe you shouldn't.
Feel like that most of the time.
All right. Dr. TJ, stupid or not stupid on the parameter, technology will continue to progress.
So I definitely think it's not stupid. I think Jason is making some really articulate scientific points. But look, dude, until my iPhone runs out of new features every time I buy a new one, I'm with Matt on this one.
Dude, your iPhone ran out of new features like three models ago.
All right, I'm at that stupid. Jason, do you want to vote or do you just want to move on?
I will withhold judgment on this one. In the interest of continuing to move on. Like, I could make an argument of stupid or not stupid, but I will give a provisional not stupid on this just so that we're able to continue to move forward.
All right, next parameter. Advanced civilizations don't destroy themselves. So this is a throwback to our Drake equation episode and the idea of great filters. Do you want to recap the idea of great filters, Jason?
Sure. So just basically the idea that there are a number of different ways that civilizations can come to an end, right? And it doesn't matter what they are. It's just a question of whether or not you're able to get through them. And this is this idea of be it nuclear war, be it plague, be it overprinting money, be it, you know, whatever happened in the movie Idiocracy. There are lots of different ways for civilization to come crashing down.
You couldn't deflect the asteroid. You couldn't paint it.
Right. Exactly. And for whatever reason, you weren't able to overcome that as a civilization, and that brought your civilization to an end. So this presupposes that that's not inevitable for civilizations.
So I can't remember what your position was on the Drake equation episode, But with the updates to the Drake equation, this concept of like great filters has been worked in because they're always adding variables to the Drake equation. And for anyone who's not familiar with it, you can go back and listen to our Drake equation episode. But it's basically a algebraic calculation that's put together to list out all the different variables that are required for a civilization to arise on a planet that can support life to the point where it has the ability to communicate out to other civilizations. And can we calculate then, based off all those different parameters, how many civilizations are likely in our immediate vicinity? When we did the Drake equation episode, the number that the Drake equation was calculating out at that time is that there are currently in the Milky Way galaxy 60 different civilizations capable of sending radio signals out off their planet. There's anywhere between 1,000 and 100,000 civilizations, but likely to be 60 that are in the same neighborhood of development as we are that are capable of sending radio signals
out. And that's just in one galaxy.
And
that's
I hope Keanu's in every fucking one of them.
So what do you think on this one? Because I'm assuming you, as a super fan, Dr. TJ, I'm assuming you've listened to the Drake Equation episode. Where are you at on this one? Advanced civilizations don't all destroy themselves.
No, I like it. I don't think they all do. I think the ones that develop social media probably might. So, I mean, man, dude, after I saw the last episode and that reference to Don't Look Up, I watched it, and oof, that is scary thinking about the ways in which we just fuck ourselves over. And I think it was social media, so maybe not all of them do. Hopefully the ones that don't have Mark Zuckerberg probably don't destroy themselves, but every other one might.
Well, this is the problem. We have no evidence one way or the other. Everything that we've seen, because we talked about this from Earth-based civilizations, talking about, you know, societal civilizations as opposed to species civilizations, we've never seen one that succeeds, right?
So, but it's not a foregone conclusion that they all would fail.
Agreed. Yeah, we don't have any evidence to the contrary, but we also have a pretty limited data set. So
we can all agree that it's not inevitable that our species will be responsible for its own destruction.
Oh, I think that's pretty inevitable. But I'm just saying that it's possible that there's some species out there that would.
That's better at it than we are.
Yeah.
And that's why
we're in the wrong timeline.
That's why we couldn't detect the pre-human civilization.
Well, yeah, that's the Fermi paradox. Where the hell is everybody? Well, the answer is they all looked at us and went, oh, hell no. Don't talk to those people. Yeah. Hard
pass. Okay, well, I'm going not stupid on this one. I'm going to continue the blazing the trail towards simulation here. I'm at not stupid.
Again, I don't think there's enough data to make a point one way or the other, so I'm happy to say, you know, let's call it not stupid and move on.
Okay. All right. Number four, super advanced civilizations want to run simulations. This whole concept is predicated on the idea that, okay, say a civilization advances to the point where it's capable of doing this. Would they want to? And why would they want to?
I think 100% they would. And I think you see this more and more, not just with social media, but pleasure in general. I think we're getting to a point where there's such easy access to content and what we're viewing and what we're enjoying. And it's so personalized in a way that it's not only very scary, but so easy to get your hands on that I absolutely agree with this part. I mean, I remember seeing, God, a movie where it was so dystopian and they had these people kind of in these complex apartment houses that never experienced life. What they would do is every single day, they would go into like this pleasure machine and just experience happiness. And I feel like if we had, you know, the ability to create some type of machine that was just pleasure or content or, you know, happy, there would be by far a majority. I don't know what the top percentage would be, but I 100% think at least a majority of people would take that path. And, you know, it's scary, but I 100% think that, you know, there's no way around it. Something that's easy and pleasurable, humans are going to love that shit. Period.
So that was basically the premise of William Gibson's Neuromancer novel, you know, the sort of the godfather of cyberpunk back in the 80s. It's also basically the plot of Ready Player One, right? Like it's kind of the same thing. I would argue two points. First of all, I think that you don't have to have a completely lifelike simulation to get to the point that you're talking about. That would certainly be a market driver, assuming you're dealing with a society that has any form of market forces. I think what's more likely to drive that, though, would be this concept of immortality, right? That there is no way to keep meat alive past a certain point. So if you want true immortality, you're going to have to figure out a way to divest yourself of the biology, and that's the only way to really do that that's viable, in my opinion, would be through this kind of a technological means. So I find that compelling. But more to the point, I think that what we've seen, at least with our own species, is inevitably, if a technology is possible, it is realized. So once we realize that we can do a thing, we do it, regardless of whether or not it's, you know, regardless of what the moral argument happens before the technology evolves, and you can nip it in the bud before you invent the technology prior to its invention. But once it's invented, the moral arguments go out the window. It doesn't matter at that point. And this has been the argument with cloning. It's been the argument with the CRISPR stuff. The horse has left the barn at this point. Like, it's going to happen. It doesn't matter what the moral implications are. So if any civilization reached the point that they could make these simulations, I think it's almost inevitable that they would.
Yeah. And I think that you really see that with the way that people enjoy content now. I mean, it's just endless streams. You can go on YouTube and spend literally your entire life and never watch every single video. It's just kind of the way that it is now with the algorithms and the way that people are kind of taking in what they believe to be pleasurable. And if we develop a simulation that feels good, and that people enjoy, we're in it, 100%. Yeah.
And yet you could watch every video that's worth watching in less than a week.
Very true.
So for me on this one, I had really 3 points. One, you guys already touched on the video game side of it. So for pure entertainment, right? Like, there will be some sort of entertainment factor connected to these simulations. So I don't know if super advanced civilizations still care about entertainment, but I have to assume that if they have the capability to do it and they would find it entertaining, they would do it.
To that point, I would argue, actually, if you're a super advanced civilization, you've basically done away with work. So all that's left is entertainment.
Yeah, that's a great point.
I was thinking that same thing too.
Yeah. There was a YouTube channel in a nutshell, and I watched a theory that they had on this. And one of the kind of analogies that they made is, think of like this, and Jason, you're going to love this. Think of the smartest, think of the smartest ant on the planet. Now that ant is walking outside an amusement park and looks up at it and says, oh, I want to study what's going on here. But there's no way, just even putting a human brain inside the ant, right? Like, it can reason and ask questions and figure things out. It could never understand the concept without the context of, like, what a roller coaster is. Like, what is the point of that to an ant? So I think that's how we have to think about this from a simulation perspective. Like, we might not even be able to wrap our minds around what they could find entertaining, because that's what we would be compared to them. And then I just love the connection from that there too, thinking about like ants in an ant farm, like people who keep ants in an ant farm were basically simulating their natural environment, and they have no idea that they basically live in a glass box on a shelf that they couldn't comprehend the world around it or the things that are taking place with a totally different species in direct proximity to them.
Given your fixation over the past year or so on ants, I've just assumed over the past 6 or 8 months that your body is a mechanical device being controlled by the smartest ant.
That made me kind of think of something that I've been thinking about in relation to the simulation episode. So as it pertains to like not being able to understand the world around you, there's this one scene, I don't know if you guys remember, in the very beginning, since it's Christmas time, in the movie Grinch, where the one with Jim Carrey, where at the very, very beginning, they zoom in on this snowflake, and they keep zooming and they keep zooming and they keep zooming. And that's actually the universe that the movie takes place in, is in that little snowflake. And I don't know, I mean, just talking about the ants and what that means to not even know, that aspect has made me fearful my entire life.
It gives you a sense
what
of
if,
scale,
what if
right?
We are that snowflake?
Right. Well, yeah. Or a bubble about to pop.
Yeah.
Well, it's that's an old science fiction trope. The end of the movie Men in Black was kind of the same thing, where they kept zooming out and zooming out and zooming out, and you go through, you know, out of the Milky Way galaxy and then out of like our avenue of galaxies, and then out to the galaxy cluster, and out, and finally you end up with this little marble in which our entire universe exists, and then zooms all the way out, and there are like these two giant aliens just playing marbles with these marbles full of universes.
Oh, yeah.
So that's actually a great segue into my second point on this one, and maybe there would be a practical reason to run the simulation. And this gets to my favorite Rick and Morty episode, where it's just they're just making a civilization inside a civilization inside a civilization just to power the civilization one level above it. I can't envision what the practical reason could be, because I'm unlike the two of you. I'm not part of a super advanced civilization. I'm not a being of higher consciousness. But there could conceivably be a practical reason you might want to create the simulation, like in that episode.
Yeah, sure, right. Like if you need your car battery to run, right?
Right. Yeah.
And I think
I think that is the best Rick and Morty episode.
And funny enough, I think The Matrix actually semi-touched on this, right? They were somewhat harvesting the feelings, right? That was the new architect.
Right. They created more energy based off their emotional responses to things.
Right.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, if
it
there
amped
is a
up
case,
the body heat and the electrical impulses. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, if there was a case, it could, one, be the energy that we're creating just through our thoughts, I guess. And then, two, we could literally just be entertainment in those marbles for those aliens, right? Jason was talking about. So who knows? Either one.
And then the last one I have on parameter four, super advanced civilizations would want to run simulations, is I could see the utility of wanting to run a simulation as a decision-making apparatus. So maybe this gets too far into Dr. TJ's free will theories here, but imagine if you have the capacity to basically game theory out every decision you could possibly make, even at a species level. Like you could just quickly run the entire existence of a universe super fast and run what would we call Monte Carlo simulations. You basically can run all the probabilities to see what would come out based off of how many flaps the first butterfly flaps its wings. Ooh. And then see every single domino that would fall over billions of years, as many times as you would need to predict the outcome of every decision to a degree of certainty. And I don't know if this will make sense to people. I play a board game, Axis and Allies.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
whenever I play the live board game and you just kind of have to make decisions off what you see and the pieces on the board, I do okay. Whenever I play online, I almost always win, because each decision you make, you could move the pieces on the board and then hit Control B on the keyboard, and it will calculate the odds of all the dice rolls going your way based off of like 100 iterations of the dice roll. And if I could literally do that with every decision in my life to a degree of certainty that I could always get the outcome that I wanted, that could be a really great decision-making apparatus for a super advanced civilization.
Yeah. First of all, if you're using an algorithm to determine the probability of dice rolls, I don't think that that's really the spirit of the game.
Winning is the spirit of the game.
A win's a win, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Secondly, this is actually the most compelling aspect of this argument that I've heard so far, because one of the questions I had on this particular parameter was, yeah, that's fine. If you can, as a species, come up with this ability to simulate reality, why would you hide that fact from the people who are in the simulation? What is the benefit? And basically what you're saying is, if we're talking about modeling.
Yeah, because you wouldn't want them to know, right? Because then you kind of track their response.
Right. But again, why were you hiding that? Like, Matt, to your point, what I'm saying is being able to model outcomes makes sense to me. That's the only reason that you would build a simulation and hide the fact that these creatures were existing in the simulation. Everything we've discussed up to this point, it makes no sense to hide the fact that people are in a simulation from them. Like or immortality, it doesn't matter if they know that they're in a simulation or not. This is the only argument that makes sense to me as to why you would hide that from someone.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
If you were going to simulate or try to, you know, get baselines on a decision in a base reality, you would have to simulate a base reality. All the actors, all the decision-making mechanics inside that reality would have to believe they were in a base reality.
No, and that's precisely what I'm agreeing with. I'm trying to highlight your point here. I'm not trying to argue with you.
So, Jason's at Not Stupid. Where are you, Dr. TJ?
Oh, I'm at Completely Not Stupid. I love this example. I think, wow, it's so fascinating to think about if we were actually able to do something like this and really kind of recreate modern existence in a way that we could track outcomes. Oof, I love it. I think that it's so plausible, and I think that if we ever got to a point where we were actually able to do this, you both would be on my side of free will. Easy.
Okay, well, that brings us then to parameter number five, the last parameter here. And this one's actually pretty straightforward. This one says if the previous four parameters are true and there are a lot of simulations out there, then we're probably inside of one. It's more likely than not that we are inside a simulation. If there are civilizations that can create simulations and there are conscious beings within those simulations, that means that there are way more simulated sentience than there is actual sentience. So we are more likely than not in a simulation if the previous four parameters are true.
I'm convinced.
I find that to be a huge leap of logic.
Do you want to expand on that, or do you?
Sure, I'm happy to. So yeah. You're making the assumption that because someone can do it, therefore everyone probably is doing it, or they have, you know, there are just these infinite number of simulations, and therefore the likelihood, you know, it becomes almost impossible to believe that you're not in a simulation. But the fact of the matter is, as we've talked about with the Drake equation, as we talked about earlier in this podcast, having to do with, you know, the idea that there, and I don't actually necessarily agree with this outcome because I think it's based on a bunch of sort of made up numbers. This idea that there are 60 civilizations within the Milky Way galaxy that are capable of sending radio transmissions. Mm-hmm. First of all, if there were 60 that are capable of sending radio transmissions, that means that there's maybe 1 to 5 that have the computing power to do what we're talking about. Maybe there's an equal likelihood that it's zero, especially since we haven't heard from any of these civilizations.
Can I just interrupt you right there, Jason, to ask one
sure.
question? This is one other idea I had based off this. Is the Fermi paradox, basically the question of like, where is everyone? Is that proof that we are in a simulation? Because if we're looking at this purely from a biological perspective, we should say life should be everywhere. Where is everybody? We would be seeing it. If you were going to simulate it, you'd save on computing power by only putting your sentience on one tiny planet in the middle of it. And that's how you keep them sheepy, right? That's how you keep them trapped and looking outward by not putting life anywhere. That's almost proof to me that we're in a simulation.
See, I disagree with this for two reasons. First of all, you know, just Occam's razor. It's much easier to believe that we're just not getting radio transmissions than it is that every single thing that we see is completely fabricated. And secondly, the idea of creating a simulation that's not just global, but is literally simulating a universe that we're able to measure, like we're finding exoplanets. We can measure the orbit of asteroids and comets, and like the sheer volume of variables involved in simulating all of that, as opposed to the idea that there just aren't people out there sending us radio signals. I find that argument completely ludicrous.
I'm not all in on it. I'm just saying more circumstantial evidence. All right.
Yeah. And on this episode, on this podcast, right. Like lack of evidence. Yeah. I've followed. Yeah.
Okay. So no, I understand where you're coming from, Jason, on that because the previous four are true, making number five, that if we're saying that simulations are likely, then we are likely in one. Isn't all the way there. That's right. A bit of a leap even for me. And so there is a fellow academic luminary out there who agrees with you, Dr. David Kipping of Columbia University. When his paper came out, Dr. TJ's colleague drank the natty daddy. What did you guys used to throw back in the student union building? you and Dr. Dave.
Also, well, natty daddy. They just don't like to admit it.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. We put a little absinthe in it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so Dr. Kipling actually, he took this question after the paper came out and he turned it into a dilemma. So basically an either or, like a two parameter equation. So he said there's either a base reality and no simulations, or there is a base reality and there are also simulations. And he assigned a base probability of each of those outcomes to be 1/2. He worked it out to say if just the first is true. So if there is just a base reality and no simulations, then we absolutely don't live in a simulation. So for sure. If the second is true, and it's likely that we live in a simulation without the ability to generate other simulations, making it almost impossible to prove that we're living in a simulation. So that builds off the idea that it takes a certain degree of computing power to create the simulation, and if that simulation gets to the point where it can create a simulation, it would have to draw the same amount of power that would just be amplified up the system to the point where there's just simply not enough energy available in the simulated universe to support another simulation.
Right.
So there would have to be a finite amount of energy somewhere in the system.
Using your Rick and Morty analogy, there just aren't enough people to step on the energy boxes.
Exactly. So I don't want to get too into the weeds, but he basically took all of that data and he put it into what's called a Bayesian formula. And out comes the answer that the probability that we are living in a base reality is almost exactly the same as the probability that we are living in a simulated reality. The odds tilt slightly in the favor, though. It's like 51-49 that we live in a base reality with no simulations. But there's a 49% statistical probability based off if you enter all those parameters and then run it out that we are living in a simulation. It's 51-49.
I would, again, I'm
like
not
this guy.
I'm not familiar with the paper. I'm not familiar with the suppositions that he makes.
But you know Dr. David, though. I mean, you can speak to his character, his credibility, Jason.
I've not read the paper. I can't speak to it at all. Again, this is much like the Drake equation. I think that all of these things are based on assumptions on variables that we have no answers for. So if you change one parameter in a single variable, that answer comes out very differently. I would assume. I don't know. I haven't seen what his math was.
There's one parameter that he points out that is basically the quotient in the equation that changes everything. And the quotient is zero now on both sides because we haven't observed it. And that is that our species, the only one that we're aware of, hasn't been able to create the kind of simulation that we're talking about. So the only variable that you can change in his equation is the moment that humanity gets to the point where we can create the simulation, it almost confirms it to a 100% probability that we are ourselves living in a simulation. The moment that humanity simulates something, we confirm the fact that we're not real.
That's horseshit. That's a variable based on a population of one. That is statistically irrelevant.
But you prove all of the previous parameters. You're basically then saying, it's the same as saying that we're the only form of life in the universe, right? If we get to the point where we can create the simulation, we're saying that we are the first base reality ever to do it, which seems almost impossible to.
But then you run into
the straight face.
You run into the cascade that he was just talking about. If you create one simulation, then the idea that there would be multiple or infinite simulations runs into the energy problem he just defined. So I
yeah,
don't
we're
understand.
Just not at the end of that line. We just exist somewhere on that spectrum.
I love it.
No. No,
even the skeptics, I'll say this, and everything that I read, everything that I looked into on this, Jason, even the skeptics who were antithetical to this paper said that they agree when you look at just basically the logic map here.
Yeah.
If humanity does create the kind of simulation we're talking about, it almost with total certainty confirms that we are living in a simulation.
I would have to look at the paper. From the information that I've been provided in this conversation, I fundamentally disagree with that. I think the math doesn't add up to me.
So you're saying, Jason, if we were able to create a simulation populated with consciousness that was unaware of the fact that they were in a simulation,
given all of the other parameters that we've discussed, the amount of energy required in computing power required to do that, and then given what you just said, that for each additional simulation you would need to be able to create that same amount of energy either within the simulation or externally,
so you're saying you would assume we were the first species to achieve it?
I'm saying that it doesn't matter who the first species was to achieve it, it wouldn't immediately become a fractal. It doesn't just increase infinitely from there. It's self-limiting by its own energy requirement, by its own computing requirement.
But there can only be one source, Jason.
There can only be one.
There can be only one true base reality. Dr. TJ, what do you think on this?
So like I kind of spoke to at the beginning, I think this is 100% right. I think it all comes down to whether or not we have the capability of doing it. And I think the reason we could create and easily, it's very plausible of why we would want to. The want is there, the entertainment. You know, I think everything kind of revolves around the capability of being able to actually pull it off. And if we do pull it off, I think if we end up pulling it off in our lifetimes, I mean, I think that we're already in a simulation. I think it's proven at that point, and I think my hands are clean. No matter what we do, I'm in a simulation. We're good.
Okay, so what I want to ask you then, if you're not stupid on the whole thing, Dr. TJ, the next question I have to ask you then, does this explain free will?
I think in a way it can, just because of the knowledge that we gain from observing the simulation to move over skeptics like Jason and yourself. I don't think these are necessarily reliant on one another in a way that, like, if the simulation exists, then my, I guess, theory regarding free will is immediately proven correct. But I do think it definitely helps because, like we kind of talked about, if there's two aliens playing marbles and they can, you know, they have the capability of kind of zooming in that marble and observing every single variable that we create, or somehow we would just kind of want to do that anyway just to gain that knowledge. I think then you kind of, from there, you have a more realistic understanding of not just the human mind, but the way that all of these variables kind of collapse on one another. And then the people like you, the skeptics, you'll look back and say, wow, wait a second. If we put Jason's mind in this environment.
In Keanu Reeves' body.
I love it. In Keanu Reeves' body, then it ends up this way time and time and time and time and time and time and time again. And so I think it would take some time. I think it grants knowledge to my side. And, you know, I think it makes it more fun, but I don't think it immediately proves it, but I think it definitely helps.
Well, I'm not stupid on it, just because I know Jason's going to be stupid. So I'm not even, my rationale is the antithesis of whatever Jason's about to explain on why he thinks, the idea that we're living in a simulation is stupid. So go ahead, Jason.
Yeah, I was soft. So out of the five parameters, I was soft on two of them and I'm a hard no on the last one. So yeah, I think that the fourth parameter was a stretch of logic that I think you were even incapable of making. And the fifth parameter is just absolutely ludicrous. This idea that if there's one simulation, then everything must be a simulation.
No, almost everything. There's one base reality.
I find that the amount of assumptions that you have to make on all of the parameters leading to that, it's like driving down a street where all of the streetlights are green all of the time, regardless of any other event. And now I understand this concept of that we've discussed many times about, you know, if the probability is one in a trillion, but you run it 100 trillion times, then it happens 100 times. Like, I understand that. But what I'm saying is this is not about running a simulation 100 trillion times. This is about the requirements to have that much information simulated. There are physical finite consequences to that that begin to defy the energy requirements of the universe. Like, there's just not any way plausible to encapsulate all of the things that you would need to encapsulate to make that happen.
So let me ask you a question then, Jason. If the simulation hypothesis, simulation theory isn't realistic, isn't feasible, what better explanation do you have for our existence and the existence of the universe? Is there a better theory that's been put forward and at least has, you know, some semblance of academic credibility? Like, these are actual, like, PhD astrophysicists and statisticians who are looking at this. Is there a better theory that's been put forward that you're aware of?
Better theory put forward for why the universe exists?
Yeah, besides the Bible.
Well, first of all, I don't even put the Bible in, like, the top five explanations as to why the universe exists. I think
scientifically, what is the universe if not that?
Well, I think that there are a number of scientific theories that are far more compelling than this argument. I don't know which, if any of them, are accurate, but there's certainly there's far more fidelity in the measurements and accuracy of those theories, those hypotheses rather, than there are in this.
Jason says far more compelling. I say far more boring. You know what?
Right, right. Because it requires actual math knowledge and adhering to the concept of chemistry. I think that it's far more palatable to me. It's far more rewarding to me to look to things like, you know, the recently launched James Webb Space Telescope that's going to look back to the furthest distance in our past in the universe. From a scientific and measurable standpoint, that we completely understand mathematically, scientifically, as opposed to this hypothetical pseudoscientific meandering as to whether or not, you know, existence. Like, you're talking about applying mathematics to an equation that is fundamentally not based on anything scientifically observable.
All I want to see is Jason's face when the first image from the James Webb Space Telescope comes back, and that first image from the earliest moment, the first light that entered our universe is transmitted back, and it's just two alien nerds looking through a computer screen. Like, we just like the side
and
of the
Keanu
aquarium.
Reeves.
Yeah, Keanu Reeves just looking in a glass wall, and that's the first image that comes back.
Yeah, holding up the number 42. Right, yeah, which would be totally awesome. No, actually, a good friend of ours, a friend of the show, Tyler, sent me a meme today. He was like, first images from James Webb Space Telescope, and it was just a covering read backwards. It said, remove before flight.
All right. Dr. TJ, you're the guest. We always give the guest the last word. Do you have any closing thoughts on stupid or not stupid? We're living in a simulation. Or any, I guess last time we gave you the opportunity to share parting advice with the listeners and you expressed your love for all of them. But
yes,
this time is yours. Do with it what you will.
Okay. So I will say I do love the listeners. You guys are awesome. But I will leave you with a brilliant quote. And this came from either me, Socrates, or Keanu Reeves. You guys can be the guests.
There's really no difference. So.
The quote is, we're either living in a simulation or we're not, but fuck it.
Oh, man. All right. Well,
I'll let the viewers decide.
with that, make sure that you get out and like, share, subscribe with this episode before our designers trip over the power cord and the whole thing just switches off. Until next time.